and welcome to Worlds Apart. Europe has to grow out of the mindset that Europe's problems are the world's problems, but the world's problems are not Europe's problems. This is how India's foreign minister summed up his country's position vis-a-vis Western pressure to take their side in the Ukrainian conflict. How is this war changing the balance of power, responsibility and wisdom between the so-called developed and the developing world? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined from Massachusetts by Krishan Mehta, Senior Global Justice Fellow at Yale University. Mr. Mehta, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting.
Now, let's start with this often quoted statement by the Indian foreign minister, which I found fascinating both for historical and psychological reasons, because here we have a former colony telling a former colonial master that it needs to get a grip, it needs to part with its infantile illusions of omnipotence, and it needs to take responsibility. How was it perceived and received in the West?
Well, Oksana, I think what the foreign minister is saying is that the West needs to get out of this mindset that its problems are the world's problems, but the world's problems are not the West's problems. And I think he's making a very valid point that when we are under stress, whether it is debt issues, whether it is inflation, unemployment, famine, climate-related crisis, the West is not there to help us. But when the West wants the global South to support them on a certain position with respect to the crisis in Ukraine, they put a lot of pressure on the global South to support them, to sanction Russia, to criticize the war and so forth. And what Mr. Jaishankar is saying is that, look, when we have our problems and we need your help, you are not there to support us. So please step back for a moment and understand and empathize our problems are before insisting on a certain...
Mr. Mehta, do you think it was heard the same way it was intended in the West? Do you think the West took a note of that statement, both in Europe and hopefully in the United States?
It's my personal view that the West's narrative is very much in favor of what the West would like to believe. But I think the voice is being heard because the global South is actually making a plea for peace. They want to stay neutral in this crisis in Ukraine. They don't want to take sides. They don't want to impose any sanctions. And, you know, if 80% of the world's population is taking this position, some questions are actually being asked in the West. That 80% of the world's population is not supporting them on this crisis in Ukraine. You know, as you know, it is mainly the US-led G7 countries with a population of around 700 million is supporting the current West position. The BRICS countries, 3.2 billion population, and many of the countries in Latin America, Africa, Middle East, and South Asia are preferring to stay neutral, to fan the flames of this fire. They don't want to take sides. And I think one of the reasons they're doing this is they are making a plea for peace. How the message gets across to the West and to Russia and the countries that are engaged in this crisis, including Ukraine, that 80% of the world's population is choosing not to supply arms, not to sanction, to stay neutral, not to fan the flames. It is sending a message, a plea for peace. And I think how this situation is now being understood, because there's more and more reporting in the press, in the Western press, why is it that this is happening? Why is it that more people are supporting? And I think that's what I tried to explain in this article
now,
that I wrote.
I'm sure I have a sense, at least, that perhaps you would agree with me, that no country, including, by the way, Russia in its official doctrine, supports war or even a limited military operation to conduct itself internationally. And yet, you know, Russia, for certain reasons, feels that it was left with no other choice than pursue this course of policy. And even though, as you said, most countries of the non-West try to stay neutral, why do you think their position at least in my experience, it seems to be far more nuanced and circumspect than the Western one. How do you explain that? Apart from the plea for peace, because I guess maybe it's a leading question, but I sense that there's something more than just an abstract desire of peace there. I think it has to do with the underground structure of this whole conflict, if not the whole international system.
Yes, I think there are some nuances to this position by the Global South, and that is perhaps best explained by a few, four or five circumstances that I will explain to you. One is, as we just talked earlier, that the Global South believes that the West does not understand or empathize with its problems. And, you know, the pandemic was a perfect example when they were left totally in the cold on this issue. The help did come from Russia, from China, from India to the Global South, but the intellectual property was never shared. And there's a lot of worry that if there's another pandemic, we'll be stuck in the same position. I think that's one reason. Another reason is that the Global South remembers its colonial history very well. And they know that most of the Western nations that are part of this alliance of EU and NATO were their former colonial powers. And they remember their history much better than the West remembers. And they also know that it was the former Soviet Union that stood by them during that very difficult trauma of the colonial history. I think a third reason is that the Global South is saying that this Ukraine war is not our war. It is a war more for the future of Europe than for the future of the entire world. But we are paying a very high price through inflation, through higher food prices, fertilizer prices, higher debt.
Well, we are made to pay very high price because it's not just the coincidence. The ones deliberately wants to put some of the burden onto the Global South. It's not just a happenstance. It's a deliberate policy.
You know, there was a very interesting interview that the president of the World Bank gave last week, Mr. David Malpass, in which he said that as a result of the West having the capacity to issue a lot of debt to subsidize its households and businesses, as you know, EU has issued almost 800 billion euros of debt to subsidize this. The US has issued a lot of debt to subsidize its people. So Mr. Malpass was saying that what is happening is that the West is devouring the capital of the world to service this debt. As a result, through higher interest rates, the capital is flowing into the EU and the US to service this debt. And as a result, the West is paying a high price because their cost of debt service is going up. Their ability to use resources to finance their own development goes down. And this is combined with inflation, with higher food prices and energy prices. And in a sense, they are paying a very high price for a war in which they had nothing to do with, which they're now being subject to pressure to try to take sides.
In one of your articles, you mentioned that Nelson Mandela often said that it was the Soviet support, both moral and material, that helped the South Africans to overthrow the apartheid regime. And I think the Kremlin at this point is trying to use a similar framing, presenting the war in Ukraine as not just a war between the two countries, and certainly not a war for additional territory, but a conflict between one country and a system that divides the global community into eternally privileged, the West, and the eternally damned or the reprobate, which may be Russia, China, Iran, and many, many others. Do you think that kind of framing resonates with the rest of the world?
You know, I cannot speak for the entire Global South, but for me, certainly, it reverberates in a significant way. You know, I come from India, which has been at the receiving end of the British colonial policies for over 150 years. As you know, Britain's GDP today is around 3.2 trillion, but various studies have estimated that during the 150 years of the colonial history, the wealth that was taken from India alone was almost 40 trillion. So just think, one country, the wealth that was absorbed by Britain was 40 trillion, and India was not the only colony of Britain. To be honest, I think the Global South remembers its colonial history much more than the West does. It is a forgotten era for them. I know people in Mexico, for example, remember that it was the war in the mid-19th century when the United States went to war with Mexico and took over California and New Mexico and Texas. American children may not remember it, but children in Mexico do. So in a sense, what I'm saying is that the memory of the colonial history is long in the Global South. It's almost forgotten in the North. And I think it's one of the concerns. And you mentioned Mr. Mandela. That kind of sentiment that Mr. Mandela was expressing, that it was the moral and material support of the former Soviet Union that inspired the Southern Africans to rise up upon apartheid, was very much understood and empathized with in the rest of the Global South. And, you know, the Global South also remembers that after independence came, it was not only in the struggle for independence, but after independence came, it was the former Soviet Union that stood by them. I come from India, the Bhilai steel plant, the largest infrastructure steel plant in post-independent India, was designed and built by the former Soviet Union. So even though Russia is not the Soviet Union and the communist systems did not transfer over, Russia is in many ways a very different country. The truth is, in the eyes of the Global South, Russia is still seen as the ideological successor.
Absolutely. But Mr. Mehta, this is such an important point, because I think here in Russia, we have had maybe 20, 30 years of being ashamed of our Soviet past. And sure, there's some very dark chapters to it, but there's also, you know, many of the good things and inspiring things and things that are worthy of respect, genuine humanitarian respect that, you know, we ourselves have to, you know, come to grips with. And I often hear, for example, from my South African guests that, come on, guys, you don't have to be so ashamed of yourself for standing your own ground, which leads me to my next question, because you mentioned before that many countries, developing countries, view the Ukrainian proxy war as a sort of a war for the future of the European security rather than the entire world. And I agree with that, but to a certain extent, this is not what I hear from my South African, Indian or Pakistani guests, because sure, they understand that Russia is out for its own security, strategic security interests that are sort of contextualized by the European security. But when one country takes on the hegemon and this system, the very exploitative and very unfair system that, you know, it wants to protect at all costs, doesn't it also have certain global, you know, implications?
I think in the Global South, there is a much clearer understanding of the causes leading up to this crisis, even though the Western position is that it is an unprovoked war. I think the Global South understand that this is part of the US-led Western strategy for the containment of Russia on the pathway to the containment of China, and NATO expansion has been a big part of it, in spite of the constant promises that were made in the first Bush administration about not an inch eastwards, and in spite of the red lines that Russia continued to reiterate about Ukraine and Georgia. So it seems to us in the Global South that the narrative has many dimensions to it, many nuances to it, but it is quite easy to sort of present it as a one-sided narrative. And I think many people in the Global South see through that. They also see through the fact that this so-called rules-based international order under which these sanctions are being imposed are really lacking in credibility and are in line.
Okay. And well, can I stop you right here? Because this is a fascinating question. We need to explore it in more detail. But before we do that, let's take a very short break. We will be back in just a few moments.
During the Second World War, in Nazi-occupied Poland, Volhynia was a farming region. Today it's part of Ukraine. Between 1943 and 1945, members of the Ukrainian insurgent army led by Stepan Bandera massacred thousands of Poles in Volhynia in a diabolical ethnic cleansing process. The murders were particularly horrific and brutal. Villages were burned and property looted. The Volynia massacre is without doubt one of the bloodiest episodes in Polish-Ukrainian history. Why are Ukrainian politicians still reluctant to talk about these events? How do modern-day Ukraine and Poland view this tragedy of the past? And why does the memory of Volynia still divide people?
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Christian Mehta, Senior Global Justice Fellow at Yale University. Mr. Mehta, just before I interrupted you, you were talking about the so-called rules-based order and it lacking credibility. And you also wrote in one of your previous articles that many in the developing world view the Ukrainian war as a sort of distraction from the most pressing issues facing the global south. But in order to be distracted, one first needs to be involved. And this is something that I want to ask you about. Has the West, over the last couple of decades at least, been genuinely involved in solving the most pressing developmental issues, not paying lip service to it, not pursuing its own commercial interests under the guise of, you know, aid or counsel, but truly trying to alleviate suffering for the sake of those who suffer? Has there been periods of time when that was manifested?
The help that has come from the World Bank, from the IMF, over a certain period of time has been helpful. But if you look at the more recent history, Oksana, if you look at what the Global South went through in the pandemic, when despite constant appeals to share the intellectual property on the vaccines, nothing was shared. We ended up, you know, one in four persons in the West was vaccinated by mid-2021. One in 500 was vaccinated in many low-income countries of the Global South. We also saw how it was Russia and China and India that came to our help. As you know, Egypt's program on the pandemic was jump-started by Sputnik vaccine. Algeria also received the Sinopharm vaccine from China. South Africa received from the Serum Institute of India the vaccines that were needed. So when help was really needed, it was not as forthcoming from the West as was expected or desired. The fact of the matter is that the help that has come in the more recent past from China, from Russia, from even India to some of the Global South countries has been much more significant. I'll give you an example. Over the past 20 years, China has provided loans to 150 countries to the extent of around $900 billion. Over the past 20 years. Now think of this, there are 193 countries in the world, 150 of those countries, most of them in the Global South, have received loans worth $900 billion from China. Just 2 weeks ago, when President Putin met with the African leaders, he forgave debt of around $20 billion that the African countries owed to Russia. So, you know, as they look to the future, they see Russia as a source of food, fertilizer and energy. They see China as a source of infrastructure, financing and manufacturing. So they are saying, is the West the only game in town? Or do we have other options as we move away from the unipolar world into a more multipolar world? Is the future of our children and our grandchildren's generation better protected by being open not just to the West, but to the other countries?
What I'm hearing you say is that Russia, China, India, many other the so-called developing countries are providing their neighbors and countries worlds apart with tangible assets, with something that they can actually improve people's lives, whereas the West continues a lot of, you know, doing the preaching. And this is something that is very interesting to me from a psychological point, this insistence on leadership, because this demand of leadership sounds very infantile, both demanding and very insecure in a sense. And because when you're a self-sufficient leader, you don't need others for validation. You know your own value and you share what you can share. But when you insist so indignantly on, you know, the homage being paid and other countries joining with you, I sense a bit of insecurity there. And this is what I want to ask you about. Do you think the West is really secure about, morally secure, not militarily, but morally secure about the kind of developmental paradigm that it's offering, or rather imposing, on the rest of the world?
I think you raise a very, very valid point, because there is some degree of uncertainty that has, in my view, that is coming about with regard to the West's positions, because they see a certain hypocrisy could be a word, but could be a certain dual standard. You know, for example, the West points to a number of UN resolutions that have come about that have been critical of Russia's intervention in Ukraine. But they totally ignore the various UN resolutions that have been there that have challenged the West's own actions in Yugoslavia, in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria, in Yemen, and so forth. So it is nice to look at certain, hold on to certain aspects that would strengthen the West's position. You know, in substance, what is happening is, when these countries are not sanctioning Russia, they're saying, in spite of these resolutions, we are taking a certain stand here that is important. So the West sees this and is saying, wait a minute, this is something to think about, because that sense of confidence and pride that they were the exceptional nation, that whatever they said, the world would look up to, is now starting to be questioned. And what the Ukraine crisis has done is, it has put some of these issues much more into the spotlight for the West. I think that 80% of the world, I mean, I saw a Newsweek article last week in which said that almost 87% of the world is not sanctioning Russia. There's a reason for it. Is it Russian misinformation? Is it Russian propaganda? And so forth. So, I mean, they are starting to question, why is the reality so different from their expectation?
Well, because for years they believed that perception is reality, but it's actually different. I mean, the reality is reality and perception is perception, no matter how much money you try to put into it. Now, on the issue of sanctions, I read recently a very interesting interview with an advisor to the Brazilian president, Celso Amorim, and he made the simple point that developing countries could not succumb to Western pressure to impose sanctions on Russia for purely physiological reasons, because when you have millions of people to feed, you cannot afford, especially if you are a democratic country, you cannot afford to put somebody's abstract values above your own very mundane and practical necessities like food and fertilizer exports. So there is a, you know, sort of governmental imperatives that countries need to take into account. And that's a simple reason for why they simply cannot afford to join the sanctions, the broad sanctions campaign, even if they wanted to. Now, I wonder if the international politics could actually benefit from this influx of the mundane matters, bread and butter matters, even though it came through this admittedly horrible war. Do you think there is any silver lining in this whole conflict that we are having, in this whole conflagration that we are witnessing right now?
I think that there is a silver lining, Oksana. One most important silver lining is that it is not possible for the West to expect that the whole world will support them on their actions, as we just talked about, 80% plus. Another silver lining is the fact that as a result of this crisis, we are now seeing a partnership emerging between Russia and China. We are seeing a multipolar world emerging that is more protective of the global South. especially if trade starts to take place in currencies other than the dollar, the opportunity of the West to sanction the Global South on a dollar-based exchange is far more difficult if the trading is taking place in currencies other than the dollar. And so I think what is the another silver lining in my view, Oksana, is the fact that because this crisis has brought the world to an edge from a survival standpoint, I think that once the dust settles on this, and that is certainly my plea for peace, once the dust settles, people around the world will come to realize that we did not need this crisis. We did not bring the whole world to the edge of a nuclear confrontation. That to protect our children's generation and grandchildren's generation, we have to go back to the fundamental security interests that each country has to ensure that they are honored. As President Putin has been saying, you cannot have security of one at the expense of another.
I think this is also very important. You cannot have the comfort and the living standards of one part of humanity at the expense of another. And we have only a minute left, but I strongly empathize with your plea for peace. But as a Russian, I also have a certain urge for fairness and material fairness as well. Maybe that's, the echo of my communist past and heritage. But, you wrote in one of your articles that the West can sustain this war as long as it takes because they have the financial resources and capital markets to do so. But is that truly the case? I mean, if we look at what's happening with the banking crisis in the United States, the mounting debt and liquidity problems, many countries divesting themselves from the US dollar. What do you think are the best and the worst case scenarios for the West itself? Should the West be concerned about its own comforts and sustainability in this case?
I think the best case scenario would be for the West to realize that we all have to pull together. We all have to be part of a secure future, and we cannot continue to just support Western approaches to solutions to problems, but other countries' interests have to be taken into account. I think that's the worst case. That's the best case. The other side is, and in my view, Oksana, is that the as long as it takes scenario is something that people are saying, but the fact that protests are taking place around the world, the fact that there's inflation in the West, there's deindustrialized taking place in parts of Europe, countries are starting to realize that this, as long as it takes scenario, is not what is going to play out in the long run, and we need to come to terms for peace. I come from a Hindu background. In the Hindu scriptures, it says there's a very interesting question that Lord Arjuna asks Lord Krishna, how should one treat the other person? And Lord Krishna replies, there is no other person. Which basically means that we all are the same, whether it is Russia, Ukraine, the Global South, the West, and we all have to find ways and means to work together in peace. And I think that's the lesson we need to take away from this crisis.
I have nothing to add but applause here. The golden rule is the oldest rule in the world. Treat others as you yourself want to be treated. And that what you mentioned is just another expression of that, that we're all part of one fabric, and there are no exceptional nations. We are all unique in our own special way, and we all have our right to manifest our destiny. It's been a fascinating conversation, Mr. Mehta. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.